With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese and Ryan Marine.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365 Sports Car Racing Podcast here in Indianapolis. I'm Ryan Marine with John DeGeese from Chicago joining me for our final year-in review episode of the season, John. This time we turn our attention to IMSA, primarily the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. An interesting year, plenty of drama, plenty for us to talk about here in 2020. We'll start by taking a look at the two prototype classes, DPI and LMP2, where we saw Elio Castroneves and Ricky Taylor team up to win the DPI championship for Acura Team Penske in its final year running the Acura program, while Patrick Kelly dominated the LMP2 season in route to a championship there. I guess maybe before we dive into just specifically the prototypes, the overview of the season, if you go back to when we kicked this thing off just about a year ago now, last January or this January or whatever it was, we had the huge LMDH announcement down in Daytona. There was a lot of optimism. I think we were actually doing some hand-wringing there, though, a little bit about the car count at Daytona. And all of that kind of seems a little bit silly given everything that transpired after that point. This was, without a doubt, John, an IMSA season that none of us are going to forget anytime soon.
Yeah, with Sebring, the 12 hours of Sebring ending the season in November, who would have ever thought that?
Right.
A second race at Daytona, a second race at Sebring.
Second race at Road Atlanta.
Yeah, that too. And then the crazy Roval race at Charlotte Motor Speedway. You know, it was, nobody could have scripted this in any different way. And I think overall it was a very entertaining season. Rivalries were born in towards the end of the year between Ricky Taylor and Pipo Durrani. You had other craziness going on in GT Daytona and on and off the track news with Porsche leaving GTLM and having to skip a weekend due to COVID. Yeah, this season had everything.
It did. Maybe too much of some things, but that's how it goes. We take what we can get, and ultimately we did have a season, so that's something to celebrate. And it was a good one in many respects, especially for our champions and for Elio Castroneves and Ricky Taylor on the heels of assisting their team car to a championship a year ago. This time it's their turn to get it done. They did get an assist, it is worth noting. It came down to the wire as well there at Sebring in a race that was as topsy-turvy as any I can remember.
Yeah, absolutely, Ryan. Castroneves and Taylor winning the championship just by a single point. And you mentioned that assist. That came at the penultimate race of the year at WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, where Dane Cameron pulled over for Ricky Taylor on the penultimate lap. And if that had not happened, we would have been looking at different champions in the DPI class with Ryan Briscoe and Ranger van der Zande. So ultimately, team orders playing out to the fullest degree in the DPI class. I guess we shouldn't be surprised. This kind of thing does happen quite a bit in sports car racing. In F1, we've seen it numerous times. Anywhere where you have sister cars, you know, there's ultimately times where you get teams that work together and help each other out. And I think that what made this one a little more controversial is just the fact that it was so evident. It was so clear on the final final restart and the run to the checkered flag there at Laguna, and it was on everybody's mind. It was talked about before the race. It was talked about in the build up to the race. So it was always a topic. And I don't think, in retrospect, now that the season's been over for more than a month now, just looking back at what the results the number seven crew had achieved, I don't think that we should be putting the team orders thing against them. You know, obviously it wasn't their choice. It was the team's decision, but just looking at how far back they came in the championship, you know, you look back at the third round of the season at Sebring there, I think there were 26 points behind in the DPI championship, seventh, dead last, basically, in the driver standings, and race after race just clawed their way back with the victories and or second place finishes up until the final race that was a dramatic one in its own right.
Next year, 26 points back is not going to be very far back at all with the new point system that comes in. But you're right, this year that was a huge gulf that they had to cross and managed to do so. That was a great story watching that take place throughout the course of the season, just clawing their way back into it week in and week out. And it did take a masterful effort from the drivers and the teams to be able to achieve that comeback and ultimately the championship. And it's a shame that my first thought and yours jumps to the team orders before it goes to that comeback, but I suppose that's the nature of it. I think, too, the fact that we had such a good battle to the end was in DPI makes this a memorable season. You had Wayne Taylor Racing with another great Rolex 24 at Daytona. That team has some magic sauce there at that race, it seems like, ever since the DPI era came into being. But you had Action Express running quite well. You had JDC Miller for a time very much in the championship conversation. The Mazdas appeared from time to time to have contending pace as well, ultimately dropped out of championship contention a little bit earlier. But that said, I think the fact that we had consistent competition, it was close, it was tight, it was difficult to predict week in and week out, it made the DPI class one to watch, even if there weren't maybe as many cars as we ideally would have liked to have seen.
Yeah, we saw a good variety throughout the year. And like we were talking about on the show last year, and I think there were three wins a piece from each manufacturer, and then I think Cadillac had a fourth, the Acura had a fourth win on the year last year. This year, you know, Mazda broke through again with some key victories, both in the Daytona sprint race and at the final race at the 12 Hours of Sebring with that car's first major endurance victory. Acura, you know, was probably the dominant force throughout the year, averaged out with the 7 crew taking victories at Road America, Road Atlanta, Mid-Ohio, and Laguna Seca. But it was still a pretty entertaining year overall, I would have to say. We didn't have as many DPIs as in previous years, but it didn't seem to really hurt the show at all.
Yep, I would agree. It was still a fun season and plenty of highlights to talk about here in the year-end review. Shifting the focus to LMP2, again, a class that we would have loved to have seen more subscription. I think there was reason to believe that it was coming prior to COVID-19 becoming the disrupting force that it became. But Patrick Kelly was week in and week out the dominant force in the class. He picks up the championship. He picks up the Truman Aitken Award as well that we'll see him running at Le Mans next year. So this is a guy who's got a great story, one to celebrate. His enthusiasm was infectious. You could tell every time he was on TV talking about the opportunity that he's had, how much he's relishing it, and I thought a very worthy champion.
Yeah, he was a man on fire throughout the year. I was so impressed by his ability behind the wheel of that PR1 Matheson Motorsports Orica as a bronze-rated driver. An incredible story. You know, 10 years ago, he was racing in IMSA in the GT3 Cup Challenge and made some GT Challenge starts in the American Le Mans Series. Then has a really severe road car accident, has memory loss, was told by doctors he'd never race again, brain damage. Ultimately, he gets clearance to go back racing, and he jumps in an LMP3, I think, a year ago and does some races and then did a couple outings last year in the LMP2 class and then takes on a full season bar the Rolex 24 at Daytona with the PR1 squad and just is the dominant force. He was oftentimes, I would say, quicker than a gold-rated driver. You know, he was paired for most of the season with Simon Trummer, and I would say Simon probably was quicker than Patrick, but just looking at those opening stints by Patrick Kelly, it was incredible to see how much faster he was than his other peers, either they were bronze or silver. Well, bronze, actually, because the new for 2020 bronze mandate in LMP2, but LMP2 didn't have the car count we had expected. It started off strong at Daytona, but then dwindled down largely due to COVID with some Canadians not able to race, other teams pulling out due to Le Mans commitments with Dragon Speed, for instance. And so it was unfortunate not to have the same number of entries that was envisioned for the class, but I don't think that should take away from what Patrick Kelly achieved.
So with that in mind, as we take a look at the season as a whole, your prototype driver of the year, John, who stands out to you?
Oh, that's a tough one. I haven't really thought about it that closely yet. I, off the top of my head, I would probably say it was Ricky Taylor. He was incredible, especially in the second half of the year, putting in some really, really, really good drives, keeping the Acura Team Penske car alive, and really stepping up when the pressure was needed. I think we could all look back at that real controversial incident between him and Pipo Durrani at Petit Le Mans, perhaps as a defining moment of the season there. But I really was impressed how Ricky handled it in the media. Didn't want to really poke the bear, or not saying Pipo was the bear, but you know, just you know, he handled himself really professionally on and off the track, and I would have to pick Ricky if it had to just be one driver.
I think that's right. That driver lineup was consistently towards the front after a slow start, and I do think Ricky of the two was the more impressive. There were certainly times where Elio shone, and yeah. Road America comes to mind, where he had a couple really good stints there and was making some pretty decisive moves on track that were crucial for their race there. But to me, Ricky, I think, did stand out to some degree. And Patrick Kelly, who we talked about a moment ago, is a great story. Obviously not the same caliber of driver as a Ricky Taylor or Elio Castroneves, but when compared to his peers, he was clear-cut the best. I think he deserves consideration for Prototype Driver of the Year. But Ricky Taylor, I'll make it unanimous, is my pick there as well. Well, let's transition away from prototype racing to the GT ranks now, John. And GTLM and GTD had their share of highlights for us over the course of the season. In GTLM, the highlight, I think, was just the domination of Corvette Racing, and specifically Antonio Garcia and Jordan Taylor in the brand new Chevrolet Corvette C8R. We were all so looking forward to seeing this car. It's such a radical departure from the previous Corvettes that we had seen from Corvette Racing, and didn't have the most auspicious of debuts at Daytona for the Rolex 24, but from that moment on, it was all Corvette all the time, it seemed like.
Yeah, we had obviously a decrease in entries in GTLM with the absence of the Fords, but I don't think that really hurt the battle for the championship. It was incredible to see how quickly the Corvette hit the ground running. You know, the Rolex 24, they did have their shares of issues, and that race obviously went to the BMW Team RLL bunch for the second straight year. But once the restart happened, and I think, you know, to their credit, they used a lot of the downtime during the COVID break to really dial in the C8R, and that thing was on rails for the rest of the year. It was really, really impressive to see the strength of the driver lineup with Jordan Taylor joining the team with Antonio Garcia, Tommy Milner, and Ollie Gavin, as we later found out, Ollie's last season as a Corvette driver. Really incredible stuff from that whole team.
It was a year of transition in so many ways from Corvette Racing. I talked about the new car, but then you have a team stalwart like Ollie Gavin completing his run with Corvette Racing. Doug Feehan, here in the last couple of weeks, we found out, has been, will not be a part of that program, I should say, moving forward as well. And he's been the program manager since its inception. We've got some new drivers coming, Nick Tandy and Alexander Sims, in full season and endurance roles, respectively. So it's been an interesting year, to say the least, for Corvette Racing. And despite the potential tumult that all these changes could have put into place, it was an extremely successful year, which I find remarkable.
Yeah, there was changes within the engineering team. There was changes within crew chief. We had Dan Binks take an early retirement, per se, after Daytona. Now, as we mentioned this, Doug Feehan stepping away as program manager following this season. And the company Pratt & Miller has been bought out by another company, Oshkosh. So some of those things are obviously post-season, but it's still mixed into the year of 2020. It showed how much change there was, yet the strength of the team still remained the same.
Looking at Corvette Racing's competition, it was a great start to the year for BMW Team RLL, and there were some highlights after the Rolex 24 win, but without a doubt, that seemed to be the high water mark. Meanwhile, for Porsche, the start to the season was pretty miserable, by and large. but they did come on strong, had to miss a race due to a COVID-19 outbreak within the Porsche camp going to the 24 Hours of Le Mans. We found out that the GTLM program was going to end at the end of this year as well, which I think made the successes at the end of the season all the more poignant and meaningful for those involved. How do you assess the two more or less full-season challengers? We'll go ahead and call Porsche full season. At least that was their intention. They did have to miss the one race, as I said. But how would you assess the year for both Porsche and BMW?
Yeah, it was an interesting mix between the two manufacturers because Porsche had come off such a remarkable season in 2019 with taking a lot of the key victories, a dominant season with the RSR, but debuting their new RSR 19 package in the WeatherTech Championship, at least. It had run in the WEC up until this year, but it seemed to struggle quite a bit. There were a lot of bad luck, miscues, stuff that really didn't seem to go their way. And something like Mid-Ohio having to withdraw at the last minute due to the drivers being potentially exposed to COVID during the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Obviously, that was a total case of precaution taken by Porsche there. And I think that was the right call to make and the erring on the side of caution, obviously. But it definitely disrupted the whole path for that team. And obviously, coming on the heels of a mid-season announcement that the team wouldn't be back in 2021, I think that really ruffled a lot of people's feathers as well from the Core Autosport Run camp. So it was a difficult year for Porsche. They had a real rebound in the final couple races of the year with victories at Petit Le Mans and Sebring, and that was a real great way to end that era in GTLM. But and when you mentioned BMW, it was a bit of a other way around for them. They started off the year with such a dominant run at Daytona, real great success for them there. And I think the M8 showed its age, I think, through some of the races there. And really, when you had the new kids on the block with the Corvette C8R and obviously the new generation Porsche, it was really not a direct match for them, even with the BOP that IMSA has in the class.
With that in mind, did a single driver stand out to you as your GTLM driver of the year?
I would say it's Antonio Garcia. He's always been one of the quickest drivers at Corvette, and I think it really showed this year. Again, no disrespect to Jordan Taylor. He was incredible through his first full season with Corvette Racing. But Garcia really delivered when the time was needed on a bunch of occasions.
I can't argue with that. It was great to see him rejuvenated as well. He had gone quite a while without winning a race, even having won a championship here relatively recently, but hadn't got that race win in quite some time. And it did seem like this lit a fire under him a little bit and reignited some of his passion for racing and for Corvette racing. So, yeah, great season for Antonio, who once again reminded us just what a talent he is behind the wheel throughout the course of the 2020 season. As far as GT Daytona is concerned, this was a battle royale towards the very end of the season. We had Acura, we had Lexus, we had Porsche in the mix, plenty of other appearances from the other manufacturers as well. At the end of the day, Mario Farnbacher and Matt McMurray teamed up to win the title, but man, they had to fight for it. It really was a knockout, drag-out kind of season in GT Daytona, quite literally sometimes. There were more than a few instances of contact that had championship implications.
Yeah, the Meyer-Shank Acura looked to be en route to the title, and then for a series, I think, of three or four races, they were literally taken out by various cars on track. I felt so bad for them over the course of the year because Mario Farnbacher and Matt McMurray had put in a great start to the season. They were, leading the championship, battling with the AIM Vassar Sullivan number 14 crew of Jack Hawksworth, who was joined by Aaron Tielitz for following the long break there before the restart at Sebring. And it looked to be MSR's championship to lose until they actually ended up dropping quite a ways back until rebounding in the final couple races. And ultimately, they did win the championship after some bad luck for the AIM Vassar Sullivan crew in the season finale at Sebring. But at that point, it was more or less wrapped up for Farnbacher and McMurray. So great stuff there for the 86 crew in MSR's final season in the GT Daytona class before they move up to DPI next year with Acura.
Pretty impressive run that the team had with the car, played such a big role in the Evo package as well, and then winning GTD championships the last couple of years with their drivers. That was a great send-off for that program and cemented, I think, their place in Honda's pecking order and made it an easy choice for them to run the Acura DPI next year and a return for to the prototype ranks for them. I thought that was great. It was wonderful as well to see the AIM Vassar Sullivan team be able to work through the issues of being a Canadian team by and large that had some American components with the Vassar Sullivan part specifically, but a lot of personnel from Canada, at least to start the season, be able to navigate the difficulties of trying to cross the border between races and events. Ultimately, they sort of cut the Gordian knot and hired a bunch of U.S.-based crew to make it a bit simpler, but to fight through all of the challenges there, have strong runs with both cars from time to time, but especially Jack Hawksworth and Aaron Tielitz, who weren't even supposed to be a full-season pairing when the season got started. That's the other remarkable thing here. To see the kind of success they had, I thought was noteworthy.
Yeah, Parker Chase was supposed to be Jack Hawksworth's full-season co-driver, but he stepped away from the team following the Rolex 24. Aaron was in the number 12 Lexus's lineup for the Michelin Endurance Cup races. That's how he ended up off kilter. But Aaron actually ended up finishing ahead of Jack in the points by 2 points over the Englishman. And it was kind of just a case of how that was. But they enjoyed a really good season together with 3 wins, a couple podiums, additional podiums in together. And it's good to see that they'll be back as a full season pairing next year. Little different makeup of the team with AIM Autosport leaving, but due to some logistical issues primarily there, but with Vassar Sullivan building up a new infrastructure fully based in the U.S. But it was great to see the battle throughout the year, you know, between Lexus and Acura. I think this was for sure Lexus's strongest effort yet in the championship, and hopefully they'll have another strong season with all the other manufacturers in 2021.
It'll be interesting to see what they can do as in the offseason it was announced that the two entities that ran the team together were parting ways, with the AIM squad targeting Michelin Pilot Challenge entry and the Vassar Sullivan side of things taking over the GT3 part of the program looking ahead to next year. Interesting that we should focus so much of the conversation on the Acura versus Lexus, because actually, when you look at the points, slotted in between the two was the Porsche, Patrick Long and Ryan Hardwick, and it's a bit fitting in some respects, John, because this lineup almost snuck up on all of us. We got to the final couple of rounds of the season, and looking at the points table, it was like, oh, well, they're in the mix here too. They've had a really good year, haven't won a race and didn't win a race until the final race of the season, and by that point they were out of the championship mix. But they found themselves with a really good year for Ryan Hardwick. It was definitely his breakout season in GT3 racing. He had some truncated efforts in the past, but he and Patrick Long and the Wright Motorsports team really seemed to click and came on strong as the year went along.
Yeah, it was a really quiet run for these guys, because I think consistency really paid off for the number 16 Porsche crew. I was really impressed by Ryan Hardwick, you know, obviously coming off of a year that was a real difficult one for him with Paul Miller Racing, having to be cut short mid-season due to an injury after an accident at Canadian Tire Motorsport Park. He worked really, really, really hard during the off-season to get fit for Daytona. He even admitted later on he wasn't 100% for the 24, but as the season went on, he got acclimated, worked with Patrick Long, did a lot of work on and off the track, getting better as a bronze rated driver. And I would say he was probably one of the better true AMs out there in by the end of the year. So hats off to them. And I think the culmination of it was obviously their win, like you said, at the end of the year. So hats off to them, like I said, and it really great stuff from the Wright Motorsports Porsche team as well.
It was a fun year in GT Daytona. Do you have a standout driver from the class this season, John?
I would say it's Super Mario. Mm-hmm. He was incredible in some of these races, and I really felt for him on a number of occasions after being like a bullseye in the back of the car. The team actually put a sign out saying keep 6 feet away for social distancing, I think, in the final couple races, and that sort of maybe helped them out a little bit to get that championship sealed. But if I had to pick one driver, I think it would be Mario.
Yeah, he was outstanding. I think Aaron Tielitz maybe deserves a little bit of recognition as well. Again, wasn't supposed to be in the car for the full season, didn't have a lot of GT experience coming into this season, but was right there on the same pace as Jack Hawksworth for a lot of the year. And I think a lot of us think very highly of Jack's skills behind the wheel, and that is a pairing that's going to be one to watch for the future. So I think he deserves some consideration, but I'm in agreement that Mario stood out above the rest. And it's fun having seen him now. It seems like he's really found a niche for himself in the Honda fold. We've seen him race in Intercontinental GT Challenge here as of late for Honda and have some success there. And then this program with Meyer Shank Racing has been a fruitful one for him. So definitely deserving and a standout driver, no question, in 2020. So looking at the year as a whole then, John, do you have a standout moment, anything from the season on track or off, that is going to be most memorable looking back on 2020?
I think it was just the incredible nature that IMSA reacted to the COVID pandemic. They had to make so many changes to their calendar and number of races being canceled and replaced. And you have to really commend everybody, and that starts at the top with John Doonan. His first year as president of IMSA did an incredible job to stay calm, collected. IMSA was facing some budget cuts with staff let go during the pandemic. A lot of people had to work overtime in order to get, you know, things done, and you didn't really see any degradation in any area of the company in any area of the series. They had all the challenges from getting international drivers into the country, scheduling races. It really seemed to impact them more than any other series around the world right now, actually, for that matter. And to see it all sort of happen and come together was a huge achievement. And that was definitely my moment, even though it's spread out for over a series of several months. I think that was my lasting memory of the 2020.
It was impressive seeing what IMSA was able to do, specifically to be able to find ways to get foreign drivers and personnel into the country. I thought as quickly as they did that, that was pretty remarkable. For me, I'm actually going to go back pre-COVID and go back to the LMDH announcement. It's hard to believe that was 2020, but it was. That was back when we were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and had hope and optimism. But, it is actually kind of the thing that's kept us going in a lot of respects through this year, knowing that this was a positive thing that was announced, hearing that despite all the difficulties that the auto industry in particular was facing, that the interest remained. And while information was not super ready in coming to us throughout the season, there was this sense that we were going to get some, and it has now happened here in the last couple of weeks where we've had confirmation. We know Audi and Porsche and Acura are headed that direction. We expect others to follow suit, and this has the potential to be a game changer for sports car racing. Thinking about the LMDH manufacturers plus the Le Mans hypercar manufacturers that have a chance to go for the overall at Le Mans, the potential of that, but certainly to have quite a few manufacturers racing for the overall at Daytona and Sebring and Petit Le Mans, that's such an exciting prospect. It's a long ways off yet. 2023 is still quite a ways out there on the horizon, but ever since January, we've been looking at that possibility with a great deal of optimism. And I will remember forever the amount of excitement in the media center at Daytona after that announcement was finally made, because it was a long time coming, John. As you know, you've been chronicling the potential for prototype convergence for a very long time, and to finally have it happen, that was a historic announcement.
Yeah, and I think even looking back at it now, with us going through this COVID era, I think it actually gives LMDH even more momentum. Just in the past couple of weeks, we've had Audi and Porsche commit to the platform. And who would have thought that both of those Volkswagen group manufacturers will be coming back into top-level prototype racing, and not just in WEC, but in IMSA as well. So it's incredible to see the strength we have in sports car racing right now, even though I think the next year year or two might be a bit difficult, with some of the short-term effects from COVID. The cost-effective nature for LMDH really is going to make it an even better success, I think, given the current financial status of the automotive world.
There's a lot to look forward to, that's for sure. How about the race of the year this year, John? I'll get mine out of the way here first. I think the Mobile 1 12 Hours of Sebring had something for everyone. Championships up for grabs, crazy, unpredictable racing. It was absolutely phenomenal, and I don't think you can look any further than that, but maybe you do.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I just can't remember a race where we had so many things happen to the championship contenders in the top category, with issues hitting all three of the cars. It was a race from the back for the number seven crew, and even though they finished, I think, last in class, they still won the title. It was just remarkable going at all the points permutations and trying to figure out who was in contention, who was not. And see, 12 Hours of Sebring just being the season finale, let alone crowning the champions in a dramatic fashion, that was definitely my race of the year.
It was really fun. That was a unique one, no question about it. All right, let's quickly mention Michelin Pilot Challenge had a really phenomenal season this year as well. The GS champions were Nate Stacy and Kyle Marcelli in a Core Motorsports car. That team's so associated with Ford. I know when we announced, or when they announced it, we reported that they were going to Aston. We had a bunch of people write it and say, we can't believe it. There's no way. This team has been Ford forever. But not only did they go to Aston, they excelled and quenched a championship in this bizarre 2020. TCR, it was the Hyundai show. Brian Herta Autosport in particular, Gabby Chavez and Ryan Norman turned into a really good team, usually fighting with their teammates out at the BHA stable for race wins, and they came out on top as champions. A lot to like about the different support series this year, John, whether it be Pilot Challenge or Porsche GT3 Cup Challenge or Lamborghini Super Trofeo, you name it. There was a lot of good racing. A prototype challenge as well, for that matter.
Yeah, I think Michelin Pilot Challenge always puts on a great show, and we saw some great racing this year, much like we talked about in last week's season review with SRO America. The Aston Martin sort of came to the fore in Pilot Challenge. Not as many of them over here as in SRO, but still ended up being a really good package, and that was definitely proven by the Core Motorsport team there. Also, tip of the hat to Carbon and their Audi. Went for two championships in a row there after their title in 2019, but came up a bit short.
Yep, an exciting season for sure. How about the future of IMSA, John? I talked a little bit about LMDH earlier. That's still a ways off, but I think it's going to dominate a lot of the talking points in the next couple of years, just as more information trickles out and as we build towards the future of prototype racing. That, to me, stands out as one of the big stories, as well as what does the future of GT racing look like? Will we have a lot of GTLM cars on the grid next year? Seems relatively unlikely. So what does that mean for the potential of a GT3 future exclusively in IMSA?
Well, if it's up to IMSA, I think we will be looking at GT3 as the sole and premier GT category moving forward. We're not going to be seeing that next year, though. GTLM will remain as a category. Right now, as we're recording this, it's only Corvette Racing that is committed for a full season. BMW is yet to officially commit anything beyond Daytona for the Rolex 24. It's likely they'll be doing more races, but it's still a question if they're going to be able to do a full season or not. There's other teams that could be in the mix for GTLM. We've heard some rumors about Scuderia Corsa potentially running a WeatherTech-sponsored car there. Still, that's unconfirmed as we're recording. But for the long term, I think we will be looking more towards GT3, probably a Pro and then a Pro-Am class. Speaking to John Doonan about this before, he seems really bullish on trying to have IMSA take the lead on perhaps a push towards global convergence for GT cars. It's going to be more difficult because we look at Europe and the WEC and ELMS, and there's a decent amount of customer teams over there with GTE spec machinery, especially with a growth expected in the GTE AM class of the WEC next year. But hopefully we'll get some more clarity on this early next year. But I can't see IMSA running a whole nother year after 21 with the current crop of GTLM cars. It just doesn't really work sustainability wise, and that's unfortunate. It'll be another end of the era, but if we can get it replaced by something that is accepted on a global stage with GT3, perhaps ACO working towards that goal as well, we could have a repeat of what LMDH has done for top level sports car racing, and having maybe two truly global platforms. And saying GT3 is global already, that's clear, but having it be accepted at Le Mans, I think that would make it a real home run there. And going back to the LMDH, yeah, we're going to have to wait a few years. It's going to be tough, I think, next year and the year after with DPI, but we do have some new teams coming into the mix. Chip Ganassi Racing is going to be making its DPI debut with the Cadillac next year. We also have the Meyer Shank and Wayne Taylor teams running the Acuras in lieu of the Acura team Penske. We still may be down one or two entries overall compared to last year in DPI, but just to look at the driver lineups in the class, I don't think there's going to be any weak links in any of those lineups for 2021.
Yeah, it looks really good, really strong, very exciting. Also exciting, I think, is the renaissance of LMP2, especially for the Rolex 24, but I think to some degree for the full season we'll see more, but definitely the LMP2 field for Daytona looks incredibly strong. Then you have to factor in the addition of LMP3 into the mix, the new qualifying format, new points format. There's a lot to look forward to as far as changes are concerned in IMSA for 2021.
Yeah, there's been a lot of announcements from the sporting regulations and whatnot for next year. Lots to keep up to tabs on, so be sure to check out Sports Car 365 for the latest on that. But we're all looking forward to Daytona and the Rolex 24. It's just a little over a month away right now, and it's hard to imagine. This has been such a short off season for these teams, especially even with the COVID stuff still going on. I think, you know, teams are still scrambling around trying to get things finalized and hopefully get some testing in before the Roar. And that's another change for next year, too. Mm-hmm. The Roar is going to be a week before the 24. So lots of change in the works for 2021. But we'll be here to give you the coverage once the new year swings around.
Not much longer now, in fact. Our next episode of Double Stint will be the first of 2021. Back to our normal format as well. We'll be getting to your questions and comments on that show, plus the latest news that we haven't been able to get to in our year in review format. So make sure you join us for that. Send your questions and comments in on Twitter with the hashtag AskDoubleStint or by leaving them in the comment section for the podcast post on Facebook. Thanks to John and Dan for helping me sift through the 2020 year in review episodes. I hope that you've enjoyed them, and we look forward to talking to you back in our normal format starting next week on Double Stint.